Welcome to All the Ways I've Failed. This podcast is recorded on the unceded lands of the Yugambeh people. We pay our respects to the traditional custodians and their continued connection to the land and sea on which we live, work and create. Hello there, my name is Beck Marshall-Say. I am a writer, an academic and the author of children's picture book Facing the Wave. All the Ways I've Failed is not only for writers but for anyone who creates, strives and fails along the way. Today I'm talking with Hugh Brakey. Hugh is a philosopher and a senior research fellow with Griffith University. His academic outputs include more than 50 research publications in which he applies his background in moral philosophy to a range of disciplines including peacekeeping and international law, professional ethics, governance and social license to operate. Hugh writes for The Conversation with thought-provoking articles on topics such as how to argue better, ethical decision-making in the context of the pandemic, and ethical concerns of cancel culture. Hugh is also the author of the novel, The Beautiful Fall, published in 2021 by the text publishing company. Hugh, welcome to All the Ways I Failed.
Oh, thanks, Beck. It's great to be here.
So before we dig into your thoughts on failure, either as a creative or as a professional or through a philosophical lens, what is one thing that your friends or family would say that you are categorically destined to fail at?
I would say singing. Singing would be the absolute thing that, which is quite annoying because I come, like my family is quite musical. My wife Kylie has a stunning singing voice and both my daughter and my son sing very well. Both of them play guitar and piano very nicely. And also a lot of my friends were quite musical types of people. So we were very much, everyone sort of gets out the guitars and messes around with them as a social thing. So that would probably be the one thing that it would have been nice to be not an abject failure at. But, you know, that's just sometimes how it goes.
You've got a background interest in acting and stage and things like that. Did you ever work actively on your singing to try and bring that up to sort of chorus level, or have you just accepted that that's perhaps not one of your strong suits?
Yeah, no, I did just accept it. When I was in, my first degree was in acting and directing in as a Bachelor of Arts drama. And we did have singing that we did in that. And I did manage to scrape through with a pass. But I remember the instructor did tell me, he said, look, Hugh, you're one of the smartest people in this class and you work really, really hard. But you do understand, I do just have to mark you on how good you are at this. And I was like, yep, I understand that. So yeah, I scraped through with a pass, which is probably pretty good, pretty lenient, really, in my case.
Oh, that sounds kind but brutal.
Yeah.
So before we get into, you know, other failures and other successes, who do you think will enjoy your novel, The Beautiful Fall?
Okay. So I think people that are interested in, I guess, a good, exciting story, but one that will make them think a little bit, one that will, you know, will cause them to reflect a little bit on, I guess, it's very much concerned with, it's about a fellow who forgets who he is every 6 months. So he has recurring amnesia and it's 12 days before he knows he's going to forget again. And he starts to fall in love with someone new who's come into his life. And so it's a sort of a love story. And at the same time, it's one that makes us think about who we are and what makes us who we are, because our memories make up who we are, but also the things that we love make up who we are. And both of them can be ways of strengthening our identity, but both of them can also be real challenges to it. And so it's a story about someone trying to navigate that. So, yeah, I think the thoughtful person who likes a good love story is probably the way to go.
That sounds like quite a challenging narrative to try and put together in terms of balancing exposition and so on for a first novel. When you've got something like that, you obviously know, or at least at some point you find out all of the details. How much do you rely on external feedback or critique to help you, you know, see your blind spots in terms of, you know, when to show or when you've told too much or where you haven't made something clear enough?
It's a really difficult question because you've got to have enough faith personally in the idea of it and the idea of the story that you've got in your head to be able to keep persevering and to be able to keep thinking, I think this is going to work. I think there is something here. But at the same time, you've obviously, and especially with it being your first novel, if you're on novel number 20, and my wife is a writer and she's probably on about novel number 20, by the time you get to that stage, you could probably take the external criticism and ideas, you know, with a much more experienced eye and work out what you want to keep and what you want to work with and what you're uncomfortable changing. But when you're a debut novelist sort of working away on your first one ever, it is really tricky to manage having different inputs coming in and working out what you're really committed to. So the story of writing The Beautiful Fool, originally, yeah, I wrote it as a screenplay. Then I wrote it as a novel. And I think I was probably so scared of rejection back then that I just sent it out to maybe one person and it sort of just didn't get read. There was no interest. And then I just shelved it. I was just, I think, so petrified of just getting really harsh feedback on it. And I was in my early 20s. I think now I probably would be a bit more resilient. But back then, yeah, I just didn't really have that tenacity to stick with it. And so I shelved it for a long time. But then when I went back to it, I think I probably had a lot of distance from it and more of a critical eye that I could bring to it. And so in the end, it went through a couple of rounds of edits. So I got the book professionally edited when I was just working on it myself. And then Text had a wonderful editor after I'd been picked up who I worked with. And fortunately, at that stage, there was in that entire period of editing, and there was a lot of editing required. I think I probably handed it to the first editor at about 100 and maybe 30,000 words. By the time the book hit the publishers, or by the time it was printed, it was around about 64,000, let's say. So that's a huge amount of cutting. But almost no plot was removed. No major changes were made. No significant scenes were cut. It was just too long in the writing and just had to be really severely, brutally cut back. And I was pretty open to all of that. I knew that was not a strength I had, that sort of writing craft. And I was pretty open to almost everything both the editors had to say. So I didn't have to sort of kill my darlings too much on that book. But yeah, we'll wait and see with the one I'm working on now. Maybe there will be much more sort of brutal questions asked of the stories that I have going on in my head.
When it comes to publishing your first book, you know, everyone sort of has a visage of, you know, what that's going to look like. And your book ended up coming out in the pandemic. Did you know, from when you signed the contract, was that pre-pandemic? Did you have a little window where you know, pictured perhaps book launches and face-to-face events and signings and all the travel and things that you could do with that? Or were you, from the get-go, did you know that you're going to be publishing in trying circumstances?
Yeah, so we didn't know at all. You know, publishing moves slowly was one of the first things my agent said to me. And so we didn't, you know, we were a long way out from 2021 when, you know, when the contracts were signed and we were doing the editing work. I was in some ways very, very fortunate, in some ways not. The bit that I was fortunate about was I actually did get a proper physical book launch. So that was really, really fun for me. And it was lovely to, you know, to get all my friends and family and all the sort of book people that I knew together. So that was very fortunate. The main way that COVID was annoying was we just started to sell into Europe. So we'd sold just as the pandemic was sort of just suddenly becoming this massive world event. We had sold into France and then we sold very well into Germany. And then the hope was, oh, maybe all the cards will fall now and you know, we'll suddenly get contracts throughout Europe. But that wasn't to be, unfortunately. So once the pandemic hit, obviously book publishers were, you know, it was just a massive, massive problem. They couldn't do any of the logistics and printing and moving the books around, let alone not having people going into bookstores, which is particularly tough, I think, as well on new authors, because people will buy online from authors that they know. But the time when people will actually take a risk on new authors actually is when they're wandering around a bookstore and they go, oh, that grabs my attention. So that was probably the main, you know, the main cost that we felt, was that suddenly, as soon as everything shut down, then everything just went dead on selling the foreign rights. And, you know, and sometimes I think, oh, if only we just had another 2 or 3 weeks, what might have happened? But at the same time, you know, on the flip side, you know, if it had happened 2 weeks earlier and we hadn't had France and Germany, then that would have just been huge. You know, those were big contracts. You know, so I was very lucky in some respects and a little less lucky in others.
You were talking about planning and the way that this was really sort of tightly woven together. Are you in that old sort of writing cliche about craft? Are you a plotter or a pantser? Did you know everything before you started writing, or was that sort of unveiled to you?
Yeah, so it's complicated because when I first wrote the first draft of this story, which wasn't hugely different. I mean, there were more characters involved and there were more different things going on. But in terms of the overall basic plot of what would happen with this guy and the way he was falling in love and the time clock running down that he sees every day, all of that was pretty firm in my mind, you know, from pretty early on. But probably a fair bit of that first draft was pantsing it, was, well, I wonder what's going to happen next. And, oh, now this has happened. Right. How will everyone respond to that? And so originally, it probably really was done quite a lot that way. Whereas when I got to go back to it, and by then, as I said, my wife is a writer and she had sort of gone on this writing journey where she had to be developing her craft over years and years and then wound up and she's very successful now. And I'd sort of been a bit on that journey with her. So I'd got along to lots of the, you know, the seminars and workshops and things like that until I felt, oh, actually, now I think I'm in a position to go back to this, you know, this book manuscript that I put down so many years ago. And so when I went back, though, then I think I was aware that this one was going to take some pretty careful crafting to get right. And so if the first draft was, you know, 60% pantsing and 40%, you know, plotting, then the main draft that I put together that wound up getting sent out for editing, that would be like 90%+ plotted. It was every scene, every chapter was pretty much written out or in full plan form before I went through and wrote everything. So I guess I probably am more a plotter than a pantser, but sometimes I still like just, you know, when you're setting out, just writing and seeing what happens. And sometimes that's the best thing you need to do anyway. If, you know, I find sometimes if I'm stuck and I can't think my way around a problem, I just start the characters talking with each other or something, and sort of you find out that they're going to figure it out, or a way of coming through the challenge that's in front of you just appears because the, you know, the story took on that little bit of a life of its own.
I have a manuscript that I think ended up abandoned at the point where I got my characters into a bath. They're on a journey. There was some, you know, big battle, respite in these hot springs or whatever, and they were in the bath and I just couldn't get them out of it. I think they spent, I spent a week and everyone's going, get out of the bath, do something. I don't know what happens next. And I'm pretty sure they're still soaking in the tub in a file somewhere. But one day I'll open it up and see what's happened in the intervening years. You have quite a big gap then between starting your first novel and what you're working on now. Is your approach different now? Does it follow that more structured style that you've developed over the time with The Beautiful Fall?
Yeah, I think it does. So the one that I'm working on right now, again, has been pretty closely plotted out. So I know all the main events, I know the main character journeys and the challenges that they're overcoming. So certainly a lot of plotting is happening, but not quite as much as what I did for The Beautiful Fall. There is just a lot more flexibility within the story, lots more characters as well. This is sort of like full-on world building, which I definitely didn't do in The Beautiful Fall. And so there is a fair bit more room, you know, even when I'm writing out a scene where I think I know everything that's going to happen, where in The Beautiful Fall, I had to be pretty ruthless. There was no leaving characters in baths here. It was like, no, you're getting out, damn it, because I know where know what you're doing next scene. Whereas with this one, there just is a fair bit more flexibility. And so there is that sort of space to let, oh, that character's actually becoming more important than I thought she was. That's interesting. So it's this one is, I think I'm finding it a sort of nice balance between I know where I'm going and I know the main things that are going to happen. But there's also a bit of free play where the characters do have a bit of life to take things in the directions that they want.
I think it would be remiss of me not to ask, how does it work having two writers in the one household in terms of, you know, writing time? Are you writing at the same time? Does having someone else there, you know, with similar aspirations and working in the same space mean that you are interested in collaborating, or do you stay away from each other? Does it motivate you to write more? How does that work?
So it depends. I mean, it is just hugely helpful. I mean, if you're somebody who's, you know, who's wanting to publish and write and publish your debut novel, it's pretty darn useful to have a significant other who has done it all before and has gone through that entire process. And in terms of sort of just the business of writing, when Kylie was first doing her work, obviously she didn't really have money to pay for editors and all of this sort of stuff. So, and she didn't have lots and lots of, you know, close friends in the writing world, although she did have a few. But those things meant that I was much more involved in what was going on. So I would have read and done some pretty strong editing of, you know, probably her first half dozen books at least, just because, you know, I was there and I was, you know, and I'd been along to the things, and I sort of, because of my earlier work in arts theater and stuff, I had a good idea about what drama looked like and all of those sorts of things. So I was able to be pretty helpful at that point. But then as things went on and, you know, she got really good publishing deals, and then she got good editors to work with at the publishing houses and other people in the writing world who she came to know and like, then sort of my role got smaller and smaller, which was a bit sad in that it was fun playing that role and being part of that creative process. But it was fine too, in the sense that it just takes up a fair bit of time, obviously, reading manuscripts and going over them and thinking about them. And, you know, when you're sort of juggling a full-time job and you're doing writing as well, time becomes something that's a very, very precious commodity. But in terms of day-to-day writing, you know, well, I mean, most of the time I'm just doing my normal job, and Kylie's at home here. She mainly works in the mornings and then does other admin and social media stuff and et cetera in the afternoons. Whereas for me, I'm sort of writing usually on Friday, Saturday and Sunday mornings is the time I like to carve out to put a few hours in and get a little bit done each of those days. But that can mean that I'm a bit inflexible on those days, because that it means that if that's all I've got to do, the writing, and sometimes I really, really want to get that writing done. So whereas she's usually doing the 9-to-5 stuff. But that said, once she's on deadline, then we're both probably similar in it. On weekends, we'll both be happy to get up and do a few hours work on the books and then put them down and get on with the rest of our life.
You mentioned your day job. How do you find, you know, working as an academic, there's a lot of writing. It uses, in some ways, you know, very similar skills and sort of aspects of your brain space. How do you find separating that from your creative writing?
Yeah, there is a fair bit of similarity in I guess just the amount of brain matter you need to be using in both. Writing books is just hard intellectual work, especially once they become pretty big, when you're in the last periods of the book and you're sort of trying to hold the entire thing in your ready access memory for both novels and for PhD thesis. You know, that can be that could be just tough going. I suppose that most of the time I like to think of the creative writing as the bit that I'm doing just for the sheer fun of it. And so I try to make sure that I am, you know, enjoying it, and I'm working on bits that I'm enjoying working on, etc. Obviously, when push comes to the shove, you know, there are just things you need to do. And sometimes you're going to be like, I don't really feel like working on this right now. And it's the weekend, for goodness sake. So sometimes it is a little bit tough, but, you know, it's still, you're always at least doing the glory part of what you want. I mean, when you're a academic, a scholar, a philosopher like I am, the actual research work that you're doing and the collaborations and the arguments and discussions you have with people are all awesome. That's why you're there, and that's what makes it all worthwhile. But a fair bit of my job is a lot of stuff apart from that, is just the logistics and the administration and the writing out of reports and the writing out of, you know, budgets and all of this sort of stuff that's really quite dreary. So at least when I turn to the creative side of things, you know, I am just doing the fun part. And so that's nice.
You mentioned your background in stage acting. I was quite interested to ask, when it comes to, you know, creative blocks and fear of failure creatively, in terms of being on stage, that's something that's quite present and immediate. Whereas with the writing process, you know, it's a really long investment of time and effort in the hope that you'll get that approval or at least recognition, or at least someone will go, oh, yes, I get what you're doing. How did you experience the two of those?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, you're absolutely right. Acting and stage acting is extremely hands-on, and even, you know, so an ordinary run-in time for getting a play up and going from an acting perspective, you know, can be something like 6 to 8 weeks, which is an incredibly small amount of time. And even when you're doing that, even the rehearsals themselves, you know, you're getting lots and lots of feedback through those periods. You're getting that rapport that you're building with the other actors. So it is very hands-on, and you're immediately pretty sure if things are working or if they're not. And when it's, you know, when it's good, it feels good straight away. So that is a big difference from writing, where, as you said, it is much more solitary and much more lengthy. And you are spending a lot of time on something where you aren't getting consistent and regular feedback on how is this going? And is this, you know, is this actually a bad thing in the end? I mean, that said, of course, I wasn't a particularly good actor, as in I wound up deciding, no, this isn't for me, you know, because acting is one of those things where you don't want to be okay. You're not going to have a career as an actor if you're okay. Pretty much all of the people who we see, you know, on stage or in TV shows or something like that are actually very, very good at what they do. And they're probably very good at a whole bunch of things you're not actually seeing on the stage. They probably sing and dance, and they probably can do Shakespeare, and they probably can do a lot of stuff, because that's pretty much what it takes to be a successful actor that is earning their money from acting. It's a pretty rare thing, and you want to be very, very good at it if you're going to make that your career. And I just, in the scheme of things, wasn't that great at it. So in the end, even though there was, you know, and I did love it, I love the stage, I still love, you know, sort of watching plays when I can. You know, it was one of those things where I was getting enough feedback that I was deciding, you know, maybe this isn't the, you know, the best thing for me to be putting my time into. And that's when I started to drift more into writing and directing, where it was sort of, you know, there was, I guess, more scope for certain types of creativity. And I felt that, you know, maybe that was a worthwhile sort of direction for me to take.
A certain degree of vulnerability that goes with both of those things. And I'm trying to think of a good analogy where you're perhaps a little bit more removed from your output, but both of them really, I know for me as a writer, I'm always very aware of that. The idea that critique or feedback is of me personally rather than of the output, because you know, you are putting your heart and your soul and your hours and hours of brain space and daydreaming into it. Are you able to distance that, you know, when you see reviews or critique or even just within your own sort of inner monologue? Are you able to separate those things, you know, the output and yourself?
Probably not terrifically well, I think. I mean, probably. So I did obviously move away from acting, and then when I was in my mid-20s, moved away from writing and directing as well. And it probably was, you know, the fact that, you know, criticism is very easy to take personally in those areas. And it does mean that it can be a emotionally fraught place to live, that is hugely exciting and wonderful when it's going well, and you know, really grim when it's not. And even with the, you know, even say my wife, who's now on 20 books and, you know, has a 4 times New York Times bestseller, you know, she'd be successful in anyone's metric. But even she avoids reading tough reviews of her work, because you've got to have that sense of belief in what you're doing. And it just is hard to muster that up sometimes. And especially if you've got some pretty negative voices flowing through your head, and then you're seeing them, you know, out in the world when people are writing, you know, pretty harsh reviews. And I think The Beautiful Four probably has, you know, a few more 5-star reviews than it has 1-star reviews on Goodreads. Say on Amazon, it's much better, but Goodreads is a pretty harsh place. But, you know, there's still definitely the 1-star reviews out there. You know, and they can be a bit tough. I guess it does depend in different ways, though. Sometimes you just think, and The Beautiful Fall didn't fit into a sort of nice, neat genre. That is a little bit of a problem. It sounds kind of cool to go, aha, I'm just, you know, pushing aside these bounds of genre. But the reality is that genre allows audiences and readers to know what they're probably going to like and to direct themselves in that way. So a number of the reviews of The Beautiful Fool that weren't great, my feeling was like, well, I'm sorry it worked out that way for you, but I don't think you were my audience for this. I don't think I was trying to give you the thing that you really, really wanted. And in a way, that is because, you know, say it was a love story, but is it a traditional romance in the capital R sense of that word? No, probably not. And so I think some people who picked it up, maybe wanting a traditional romance, were like, it's not really that romantic. Whereas other people who were sort of like, oh, it's a love story, but it's not a romance, and I'm happy with that. They really connected with it. So that's all to say that sometimes you read a bit of a harsh review and you'll be able to say, okay, I don't think it's me here, and I don't think it's really the quality of my work. I think it's just that we weren't aligned. This was never going to be the book for you, even if I'd written exactly the most perfect version of this story I ever could. I don't think it was what you were looking for right now. Whereas the ones probably where it's easier to take it to heart are ones where you get the sense that the person reading was actually someone that you were targeting. This was the type of person who was looking for a book that was something like yours, and yet you dropped the ball there. You weren't able to take them on your ride. Yeah, and that is just a bit hard to, that is just a bit hard to take, because that's, you know, what you're in the business of, after all. You know, you do want other people to connect, and it is, you know, a wonderful feeling when you get that great review and people were saying, this is the best book I've read all year, and this is the most interesting, surprising thing that it wasn't what I was expecting, but I loved it. Those are great, but just as you take them to heart and they make you feel good, well, it just necessarily follows that the harsh reviews are also pretty grim, and it can be difficult not to say, oh, well, that's me they're commenting on. This was the best I could do. And it is a really personal, you know, you are sort of building castles in your mind and showing them to the world. And if somebody says, well, that's not really very well done or interesting, then, you know, it's hard to think that isn't a comment on you and where you're at.
And we do tend to magnify and remember that, you know, that one cutting comment that, you know, really struck at our biggest insecurity over 20 or 50 great things that people say that we're probably more inclined to brush off. And then we, you know, again, replay the relatively small, but, you know, no less sort of, you know, impactful, harsh things that we've heard.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I actually, a few months after the book came out, I actually went, right, that's it. I'm putting together a document of all the good reviews, just so anytime I come across one of those bad ones or when one is just playing on repeat in my head, I can go back and go, well, no, look at how many and of these great responses that you had. And yeah, there were some bad ones, but don't go thinking that was the normal response.
And your background is in moral philosophy. You spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, decision making and, you know, structures to guide good decision making and so on. But through your experience with philosophy, is there anything that has helped you create your own sort of, I guess, lowercase p philosophy with respect to failure and how you navigate those type of challenges?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, certainly there are some philosophies that really, you know, that really do confront these types of things. I'm thinking probably of the Hellenistic philosophy of Stoicism, which the word Stoic nowadays isn't a bad approximation of what they were doing, which is odd because sometimes when people use like Epicureanism, it's completely the opposite of everything Epicurus was about. But Stoicism is about right. It's definitely one of those philosophies that really tries to keep things in perspective and that wants to remind you when things are going well, not to get too carried away that, you know, there will be, you know, that everything is impermanent, good things you've got now won't last forever. And it was, you know, the philosophy was created by some people, sometimes former slaves who'd had very grim lives and had learned how to wrestle with them. And so, and there is this significant overlap. If you, you know, modern day mindfulness just has a lot of, you know, Stoic themes in it. Yeah, so philosophies like that can be really good. And I guess from studying philosophy over the ages as well is a good way of becoming, I think, a little bit humble, because most of the time when you're reading, you know, the philosophical greats, these are amazing thinkers. These are thinkers that weren't just the best in their time and in their generation, but consistently, you know, explored and thought about for centuries or millennia on end. So these are some pretty impressive people, but they disagree with each other a lot. And that means that a lot of them had to be wrong about most of what they were saying. And so I find that helpful, because I think that it does remind me that when it comes to hard topics, you know, we're all going to get things wrong, and we're all sort of moving and fumbling a little bit around in the dark. And if people who were that impressive and that amazing could be so clearly wrong about so many things, then maybe it's sort of okay for me to be as well.
So when most people think about being wrong, that that actually feels like a failure to them, that it's a personal failing or an intellectual failing. You've done a lot of work on argumentation and, you know, creating a good argument or an effective argument. Can you elaborate a little bit on, I guess, the benefits of being wrong in terms of, you know, shaping a better worldview or being a better arguer and engaging with others generally?
Yeah. So, I mean, it is one of those funny things, but the person who's wrong in the argument is, in a way, is the one that wins. I mean, this is something that Socrates was very big on at the sort of dawn of Western philosophy, was the one saying, if you take two people and they're in an argument and one of them persuades the other one that they were wrong, who walks away with something? Not the person who won. It's the person who lost, because the person who lost had a belief that was probably wrong or unjustified or poorly evidenced or poorly reasoned. And they've fixed that. They're walking away with this gift from the other person, which is that now they have a true belief or a more justified belief or a belief that sits better within the sort of coherence of their overall thinking. And so arguments have always been funny like that. It's a contest, and one side wins and the other side loses. But in terms of who gains, and who gains from a knowledge base, a question of understanding and what we know and learn about the world, then it's the person who loses the argument that's the one that walks away with something. So I think that's one of the main reasons why losing an argument isn't something we need to worry about too much. I mean, it is something we need to worry about in that it does seem personal. You know, if you're wrong about something and you're speaking about it publicly, and then it turns out that oh no, actually the arguments against that are sort of devastating, then that just is a sort of social cost. And it's important to just accept that that's the case. There's no point lamenting it. Our brains are just wired that way. We do care about our social status. And one of the parts of that status is to being perceived as being competent by others. And when we find that we've been wrong about something, and something we've been saying perhaps to other people, and now we think, well, we've been misleading them, that is a grim thing. So it's absolutely fair and legitimate to feel like you're being personally affronted if somebody looks like they're proving you wrong, and that's okay. But at the same time, it really is a learning experience. You're going to learn a lot more from the arguments that you lose than from the arguments that you win.
When you look back at the bumps in the road in terms of your writing or your career or your study or anything like that, are you someone who's able to look back at those and go, oh, well, they all got me to where I'm meant to be? Or do you think, oh, wow, it would have been nice to get here without that messy bit or that big weight or that hiccup?
I suppose it depends a lot on my present mood, really. I mean, sometimes you will look back with amazement and you will think, oh, well, if that hadn't happened, then this wouldn't have happened. And, you know, if I hadn't had, you know, as I said, I was very into the performing arts early in my life. I thought that that was the way I was going to go. And then I moved into writing in, you know, plays and then screenplays and then books. And I thought maybe that was where I was going to go. And there was a period probably when I was in my mid-20s where I was sort of like, I don't think this is working. I don't think this is what I'm good at and meant to be doing. And I think I need to try some different and other things. And that was probably pretty tough. It probably was, you know, that decision was a couple of years in the making, you know, and it was a pretty grim one, I guess. But at the same time, I don't think I sort of ever completely lost hope. I sort of always had faith there'd be something around the corner that would wind up working out. But it certainly was a tough one. And it's funny because in some ways, like, say, the acting and stage acting, I look back now and go, it was probably good that I got the critique that I got there, because I just don't think I am as talented as most of the people who I worked with, for example, who were around me at acting school. But then other times you think, oh, well, I wound up sort of walking away from from writing. But turns out, you know, this the same idea that I had all the way back then, well, it actually was a good idea, and actually did make for a good book that was, you know, that was able to be published and able to be sold, and lots of people liked it.
It's really interesting when you talk about, I guess, the stage acting and how much you enjoyed it and the directing, that I think we pin a lot of our sense of success and identity to the job we do, that's, you know, what do you do for work, rather than what are you passionate about, what brings you joy. And it sounds like it's still something that has brought you some discomfort, but a lot of joy, and it's certainly going to inform how you engage, like you said, with plays, with films, and something that's greatly beneficial in its own right in terms of informing that sort of broader tapestry of who you are as a person and your identity.
Yeah, it is funny the way we do define ourselves so much through the roles we have at work. And I think I'm definitely, that's one of the things I do. I probably think of myself as a philosopher more than I think of myself as lots of other things. And so it is, you know, it is something that's important to me. And you know, the job just can be wonderful. There are times in the week where I think I just get up today. I've done all those other things I had to do. I get up today and I get to do philosophy, and that is just awesome. So yeah, so it is one of those things where it's good to follow your dreams. You have to be pretty wise about doing it, and you have to be aware that it won't all be smooth sailing. Whatever jobs you go into, there will be difficult and challenging and frustrating bits. But certainly, you know, it does work sometimes. You do manage to get the thing that you think, yeah, this is what I'm meant to be doing. I have found my thing, and that's a great feeling.
So what's next for you in your writing? You're working on another book. Has that got a lot to go before you're at that first draft stage, or?
So it is. So my one of the things that changed my life was my wife, my then girlfriend Kylie, handed me the book Sophie's World when I was 27 years old. And that, as many people know, is a pop philosophy book. It was written ostensibly for teenagers. The protagonist is a teenage girl. But apparently was actually mostly, in the event, read by people like me, i.e. people in their 20s or 30s who hadn't been particularly exposed to philosophy earlier in their life. And it was a really watershed thing for me, because I'd never realized that other people spent their time thinking about some of the weird stuff that was going on in my head, and that I wasn't alone in that respect. And so I'd always thought it would be nice to write something like that, but for moral philosophy, whereas Sophie's World is written mainly about metaphysics and epistemology, so theories about what exists in the world and what we can know about what exists in the world. And that's pretty dry going. And even for somebody who's pretty enthusiastic about the philosophy, Sophie's World can be pretty dry in parts. But I always thought, well, it'd be great to do something like that for moral philosophy and ethics, because that's just super interesting from start to finish. And everybody has an opinion, and everybody's like, oh, really? Someone thinks that? That's interesting and perhaps worrying. So I thought it would always be fun to do something like that. And so for years, I tinkered around on the idea of something like a Sophie's World meets Hunger Games kind of tournament, where these people are battling for using sort of philosophical arguments against each other, and there'll be a huge revolution and everything will happen. And so I thought, oh, that sounds like a really interesting idea to run with. And the sort of thing that I thought I could do, because I can sort of bring my two halves together. And so I've been doing that, and it's been super fun and very exciting and pretty challenging. But most of all, it's been long. So my agent pales every time I tell her what the word count is looking like. So we'll wait and see if I wind up with a saleable product at the end of it, because I'm probably, so at this point I've decided it's probably going to be done in about three books, not one book. And I'm about 120K at the first book, which is just finishing. So it's at first draft stage right now.
If people want to find The Beautiful Fall or keep an eye out on your Hunger Games moral philosophy mashup, where can they find you or keep track of you?
So they can find me under my name on Instagram or on Facebook. I have an author page, and they can find me online just at www.hughbrakey.com.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining me, Hugh. Thank you for talking about failure and success, and all the best for your upcoming project.
Terrific. Thanks, Beck.
Thank you for listening to All the Ways I've Failed. You can find details about our guests and their work in the show notes, and you can find me on Instagram at All the Ways I've Failed or at Beck Marshall Say. Please rate and review wherever you listen to podcasts so that others can hear the beautiful and generous stories of our wonderful guests.